This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 90 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, November 22, 2017, to accommodate the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. I'm Eric Townsend. Francesco Filia from Fasanara Capital will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll be discussing everything from why Francesco believes that both the bond and equity markets are in a bubble. We'll discuss positive feedback loops and systemic fragility, and why the popularity of risk parity and short volatility strategies pose a systemic risk, in Francesco's opinion. Be sure to download Francesco's chart book, as we'll be referring to it throughout the interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview for our post-game segment, in which Patrick and I welcome back Kevin Muir. Kevin has some excellent perspective to share with us pertaining to inflation, the bond market, and particularly short volatility strategies that you're not going to want to miss. We'll also give you an update on our year-end special featuring Luke Groman, Jeff Snyder, and Mark Yusko, which is rapidly evolving to something bigger and better than we even imagined it ourselves.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 broke again to all-time new highs this week. It really looks like that market correction, not even a few percent, and back to the races we are. Is this thing going higher from here?
Oh, I think so. You know, another week, another all-time high. Francesco is going to have plenty to say about why he thinks the market's in a bubble and why there are plenty of systemic risks that exist. So I definitely agree with him on that. But I think he acknowledged as well in this interview that, hey, you know, bubbles keep blowing up until they pop. It's going to be ugly someday. But right now, this thing keeps on blowing. I'm sticking to my story from what we've discussed in the last couple of weeks, Patrick, which is if you don't want to miss out on the upside that's left in this bubble, and I do think it's a bubble, that's very understandable. Do it with options so you protect your downside risk, because I think it's probably got a while to go that we're going to see more upside in this stock market. Someday this is going to end very badly, and it's a mistake to try to rush to the exit ahead of everybody else when it happens. You want to have your risk controls in place ahead of time. I'm annoyed with myself, actually, for not putting on the ratio call spread trade that you've described in the program on this dip that we had last week. You know, I meant to do that. I was so busy with other trades that I neglected to do it, and we're back to all-time highs. So I'll be waiting for another dip.
Well, you know, Eric, I'll tell you, I don't think you need too much of a dip to get in, because if there's going to be a breakout, technically, there's still lots of room on the upside. And so, you know, even though it's always nice to enter those trades on the dips, if this market's going to rip at some point, those ratio call spreads are still a half decent idea. Nonetheless, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, where we have today a pretty good drop in the dollar index. We're headed down to this 93.11 area, and it looks like the correction on the downside is underway. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Yeah, you know, I definitely had been leaning toward the scenario where the bull trend resumes and continues. But the failed inverse head and shoulders pattern, I mean, we saw a clean break through that neckline, and then it rolled back over and fell back below it. Juliet de Klerk, I have a huge amount of respect for. When, as I mentioned last week, when I spoke to Juliet on the phone to book her for an interview later this year, she told me that she had just reiterated her bearish call on the dollar. Now, that was last week. Look at what's happened. She's been right so far. So we also taped the year-end special this week and got some more bearish perspectives from Luke Groman and Mark Yusko. And I was actually surprised at how readily Jeff Snyder was willing to agree with some aspects of what Luke and Mark said. Luke in particular makes a point, and we're going to get into this in gory detail in the year-end special coming up at the end of December. But the point that Luke makes is he says, look, the U.S. dollar being in a shortage, which clearly it is, that's something that Jeff Snyder and Luke Groman agree on, is definitely positive for the U.S. dollar until it isn't anymore. And the big question that we discuss in great detail is exactly what does that mean? When does it stop being good for the U.S. dollar? And I was surprised at how readily Jeff Snyder acknowledges, look, so far it's been positive for the U.S. dollar. It does have to change someday. And Luke described some of the reasons that he thinks it's changing now. So I think there is room to say that maybe the bears have it right here. The real tell, though, is below 91 or above 97 on the dollar index. You know, above 97 would be more than a 61.8% retrace of the move down from 102 spot, whatever it was. And below 91 was the recent low. Until we see that, I don't know that it's definitive, but I think things are starting to line up in favor of the bears here. Julie, it's already booked in December, so I'll definitely look forward to getting an update on her perspective when we have her on the program.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, which just ripped higher to the 58 handle. I was thinking that that was a level where there was going to be some overhead resistance, but it feels like crude oil wants to go to another level. What's your thinking here on oil?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Keystone Pipeline is a really big piece of this. But let's start with inventory, as we always do. Crude oil drew down 1.9 million barrels nationally. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline building 44,000 barrels. Distillates building 269,000 barrels. Production rose again to 9.658 million barrels per day. And the Baker Hughes rig count ticked up 8 rigs. So we're really starting to see some action on the Baker Hughes. That comes on the tails of, we've been hearing for several weeks now about increased hedging activity, which shows up on the commitment of traders reports in the form of short interest expressed by the commercial swap dealers. Meanwhile, exports are up again dramatically, 1.591 barrels, but they measure those per day. So multiply by 7, you get 11.1 million barrels exported last week. Now, in reaction to inventory, the tape action was fairly muted. There was a little bit of a tick down, but it only lasted a few minutes and then drifted higher and a little bit down and then higher even still. And we've moved up higher. The really big story this week, though, was the Keystone Pipeline. Now, it's important to understand because sometimes people confuse the Keystone Pipeline that people talk about as a contentious political issue. That is actually the Keystone XL extension to the existing Keystone Pipeline. The news story this week is about the existing Keystone Pipeline, not the one that's proposed. It sprang a leak, basically. There was a pretty significant leak. And among other things, that means that they're going to have to shut down 85% of delivery capacity from Canada into Cushing, Oklahoma. So all of that oil that normally flows through the Keystone Pipeline from Canada down to Cushing is going to be cut short, really only for the next little more than a week. They're saying through the end of November. But still, that is 590,000 barrels per day of imported oil from Canada that's going to be shut down just temporarily. That's equivalent to about 3.5 million barrels of oil that's going to be missing. Now, there's plenty of oil in storage in Cushing, Oklahoma, so we're not going to run out of oil or anything. But that actually really, really surprised me, Patrick. It tipped the entire WTI term structure into backwardation. In other words, the front month is now the highest priced contract. All the subsequent contracts are less than the front month price. And that condition has not existed in WTI in a long time. Now, logically, it makes perfect sense. If you have a shortage of oil in Cushing, which is what's going to be created by this pipeline shutdown, it does make sense to move in that direction. But to be pushing the curve all the way into outright backwardation on this, you know, what is expected to be about a 10-day outage really surprised me. This is going to be very important to watch because there's a number of positive feedbacks in the term structure of crude oil, where basically once it gets into backwardation and the whole structure's in backwardation, that incents behavior that tends to reinforce keeping it in backwardation. So usually when it shifts from contango to backwardation, it stays that way for a long time. So is this going to be just a temporary blip where this backwardation across the term structure is short-lived and we revert back to contango at the front of the strip as we're used to seeing in the WTI term structure? Or have we actually seen a secular shift in the shape of the curve here? We'll find out over the next few weeks, but I was very surprised that it happened on what to me, I mean, it was obviously a big deal that this leak happened or this spill happened, but it wasn't, to my thinking, nearly big enough to cause this kind of distortion of the term structure. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens. The big skew that I see in market perception right now is almost everybody, Patrick, including people who are professional journalists that focus only on energy markets. We're supposed to know better. Keep saying the same thing, which is, hey, it's a done deal. The fix is in. We're going to have a extension of production cuts to the end of the year. That was signaled by Saudi Arabia, and that was signaled by Russia, although, frankly, it may be changing from Russia in the last few days. Look, I don't know if these folks bothered to look up what the rule book says, but this requires a unanimous vote. So it only takes one country to say no. And I do think that this extension of cuts is likely. So I'm not predicting that it doesn't happen, but everybody's assuming it's a done deal, and it's not a done deal. I see plenty of room for a bearish surprise here. If they were to say, well, price of oil is kind of recovering nicely, maybe what we'll do is we'll extend it for 3 more months. That gets us to our June meeting, and we'll revisit it at that point and decide if we need any more. That would be a big disappointment because everybody's already cooked in the price to expect that it's going to be through the end of the year. If they didn't come up with an extension at all because one country dissented and wouldn't vote for it, that would be a bearish surprise. So there's lots of room for bearish surprise. How do you get a bullish surprise? What could they possibly do that's more accommodative than to extend this production cut to the end of the year? Extend it for 2 years? That's not going to happen. Although I do think probably the most likely outcome is what everybody's expecting, which is the cuts get extended. I don't think the market is in any way, shape, or form positioned for the potential downside that could occur if there is a bearish surprise from the meeting.
Now, Eric, let's take a step back here and actually just take a look at the bigger picture on oil. What do you think is actually going to happen here going into the next year?
Well, Patrick, let's step way back to the big picture. My view has always been that once this supply glut clears, we're headed for much, much higher oil prices. Peak cheap oil is very much still a real phenomena. A lot of people have forgotten about peak oil or think it's been disproven or something. That's nonsense. But I've felt that we still had one more significant wave down in oil prices that I thought would come in the end of 2017. We'd seen a final low, and that would be the big buying opportunity. Evidence is mounting that I may have missed that big opportunity, that June 20th, the $42 low, may have been it. I thought we had further to go than that. OPEC disappointment next week could be the catalyst to prove me right, at least on one more big leg down. I don't know how far down. If not, it's time to reevaluate because we're definitely seeing U.S. inventories going down dramatically. Now, personally, I think that's being gamed, at least partially. I think that this narrative you hear that there's no spare oil left anywhere in the world except the United States, the U.S. has the surplus of oil, it's gone from every place else. That's nonsense. The U.S. has the most visible surplus of oil because the EIA measures it so carefully, and therefore it's transparent. I think that there's plenty of oil being stored, particularly in China. So I don't think the glut is over yet, but it doesn't really matter. If the U.S. inventories continue to come down, that gaming of the system will be effective. It is U.S. inventory that plays a major role in the price discovery process. So there's a huge divergence in the biggest professional oil traders. There are people that say $45 Brent is going to be where it's at for all of 2018. Other people who are also major, major players in the market are saying, no, 70 is going to be the floor for Brent by the end of 2018. Who's right? I was leaning with the 45 crowd. The evidence is mounting in the other direction. I think the real tell, you know, we're at a crossroads here. The opportunity to see another move down is going to be if OPEC disappoints, there is such massive, massive speculative positioning on the long side. Everybody's on the same side of the boat. A disappointment from OPEC could be the trigger that ignites a massive sell-off. If that doesn't happen, we get through OPEC, the price continues to power higher. I think it's time for people like me who've been predicting another deep draft down. Myself, Raul Paul, a lot of people have had that view. Maybe we're wrong and we really are headed higher from here. Certainly it feels like the market thinks that the end of the glut is in sight. I didn't think it was. I guess perhaps I'm wrong. We'll see what happens.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold because, you know, as soon as that dollar made that breakdown, gold is already once again heading right back up. It's right now trading around 1291, but it looks like it's going to once again try to test that 1300 level. Is it going to break this time or is that this kind of choppy trade range purgatory that gold's been in going to continue?
Well, Patrick, I think the chop that you're talking about is attributable to the geopolitical risk that's just been up and down and left and right recently, and I think that's going to continue. But if you kind of fade the chop and look at the trend, you know, we're looking at higher highs and higher lows in this pattern of chop. You know, since we had Jeff Christian on the program, we're in the low 1260s. He said that's probably going to be a bottom for the near term, and so far it has been. So it's looking pretty good. I was hesitating around a long view on gold because I was really kind of leaning towards that bullish dollar scenario, and I think that really would paint a pretty serious headwind for gold. And it's starting to look like Juliet de Klerk is being proven right, and maybe we're headed down. And considering I've waited this long, I think I'll wait for a break below 91 on the dollar index to persuade me of the bear case really being true on the dollar. At that point, you know, I probably will have missed some more upside between here and there, but at least I'll know that I really have conviction about that trade. Right now, I still feel like there's room for the dollar to reverse to the upside, and gold could potentially take it on the chin if that happened. Remember, Juliet de Klerk added gold to her long view in addition to the euro, so she's definitely got a fantastic track record. We're going to get her on the program by the end of the year, as I said earlier. I think, though, that the really big trade for gold, the one that I see as the trade of a lifetime, which is where the real end game is on for the U.S. dollar, and the dollar is failing, and gold is the safety trade of a lifetime. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we may be seeing a slow decline in the dollar that is going to play very well for gold, not so much as a, you know, amazing super duper killer trade, but just as a good place to, you know, good position to have in your portfolio. So there's nothing wrong with starting now as long as you're ready, as Grant Williams has said, to ride out a downdraft. If the U.S. dollar does take another leg higher, it's going to present a headwind for gold. Looking forward, we did discuss this with Jeff Snyder, Luke Groman, and Mark Yusko in the year-end show. So look forward to that too at the end of the year.
All right, well, let's move on to those 10-year Treasury yields, which were pretty much at the lows for November, testing around this 232 level. It really looks like these bonds are ripping higher and the yields may break here. What's your thinking on interest rates?
You know, I don't really have anything new this week, Patrick. What surprises me is we're still treading water, basically 233 or so, around the same level on the 10-year as we were last year. You know, we've got a nomination for the Fed chair. You'd think that there would be a trend developing here, and we're just treading water. As I mentioned, Juliet will be back on the program. She's been very, very right on the 10-year calls that she's made this year, so I'll be very curious to find out if she's still short. But for now, I don't really have a strong view.
All right, well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview, we have Francesco Filia of Fasanera Capital will be joining us. Eric's interview with Francesco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Francesco Filia from Fasanera Capital in London. And Francesco, I'm really excited to get you on the program because as an engineer, I think in terms of things like feedback loops. And I know that you look at finance in some terminology that's very familiar to me. So you've sent us a wonderful slide deck that I strongly encourage our listeners to refer to. Registered users, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the red button above Francesco's picture that says looking for the download, and you'll get instructions to get registered and get the download. Let's go ahead and jump right into your presentation. Why don't we start with page 3 here? You're talking about an equity bubble, very much something that's near and dear to my heart. And just so you know, we've tried to position, we had a guest last week who's sort of saying, don't worry about the bubble, don't worry about valuations. We wanted to bring you in to give the contrasting view. So tell us about the equity bubble and what you see on the horizon.
Yeah, sure. No, thank you, Eric. And I think the equity bubble is quite uncontroversial. It's quite unambiguous. There are a lot of different valuation metrics for those that they care to look into them. They've been valid for over 100 years of modern financial markets, and this time is no different in that respect. There are usual metrics that valuation guys are looking at, like financial assets to disposable income, that shows that this market is way more expensive than at any point in history, including also the big dot-com bubble and the Lehman moment in 2007-2008. But there are other metrics like the Buffett indicator, market cap on GDP, the median debt on total assets, the corporate debt to GDP, the price on sales, the price to book, enterprise value on sales, enterprise value on EBITDA. There are a number of different metrics. They all convene that this is a market bubble that has not been seen before in history. The only one metric that makes a little bit less acceptable and tolerable is the comparison to bonds, which unfortunately are themselves into a bubble, and so they don't provide much help in this respect. And we will go through that in a moment. But you know, we at Fasanara, we developed our own indicator just to try to add something to what was available already. And we started from the most famous of all indicators in this respect, which is the Shiller adjusted the P/E ratio or the CAPE ratio. This is the most famous. Professor Shiller got a Nobel Prize in 2013 for it and for his studies on market inefficiencies and for the ability to infer future expected returns from valuation metrics such as the Shiller P/E. And based on the Shiller P/E, which what it does is simply to compare current prices to not spot earnings or foreign earnings, but a more reliable measure of the average of the last 10 years and adjust it for inflation. So the average of the last 10 years of real earnings. And on the basis of this index, we find out that the market is as expensive and just a little bit less expensive than it was in 1929 during the Great Depression, the peak of the market before the biggest collapse in equity prices ever seen, and year 2000. So it's just slightly cheaper than year 2000. From that point onward, you know, that index itself has got a few critics that they say, yes, but wait a minute, because of the great financial crisis in 2007-2008, what you have the distorting effect of those low earnings. So if you do the average is, you know, impacted by those low earnings. So what other people like John Hassman, very famously came out with, what they do is they adjust this P/E ratio for peak earnings instead of average earnings. So to diffuse the most common critic to the Shiller adjusted ratio. On the basis of the Hassman ratio, if you want to call it like that, the market has never been so expensive except in year 2000. So on the basis of the Hassman ratio, the market is more expensive than 1929, but it's not as expensive at year as in year 2000 as yet. Then Hassman also looks at adjusting the ratio for profit margins and finds out that this market is yet more expensive also than year 2000, but on the basis of his indicator based on peak earnings, you could still argue that this market is not as expensive as in year 2000. What we do is just an evolution of the Hassman P/E ratio, which is taken from the Shiller ratio, which is to compare, which is kind of putting all in the basket. So we put the peak earnings as opposed to average earnings. And for peak earnings, we really mean a peak. So we take the two top quarters over the last 40 quarters. So we cannot really be seen as being any more generous to the current markets. We take the two peak quarters on the last 40 quarters. And then what we do, though, is we compare these price earnings on peak earnings to potential growth or trend growth. Because the point here is that, you know, like what you pay in terms of stocks should compare not just to the past or the earnings proposition, but also to the overall economy general. Because, you know, if the overall economy has a lower potential growth, you should be expecting to be able to pay less in terms of multiples than otherwise. The overall economy has a big correlation to earnings and to profit margins. So you should expect the potential growth rate of the economy to be quite relevant when it comes to PE multiples.
I particularly want to focus on page 4, where you talk about the bond bubble as well, because this is something that I think so many investors in the U.S. are not adequately focused on. We have not only a bubble in equities, but a bubble in bonds. And this, to some extent, flies in the face with traditional wisdom, which says, you know, the assets flow from the equity market back and forth to the bond market, depending on investor sentiment about risk. We got bubbles in both at the same time. How is that possible? What's driven it? And what does it mean?
Absolutely. I mean, the only point that you could say about the equity market is look at the interest rates. Interest rates are so low that they justify this eagerness of investors to be able to pay these high multiples on stock. And our point is, no, look at bonds and look at how they compare to history and how they compare to metrics such as inflation and the GDP, to which historically they are very well correlated. And you find out this chart on this page, which is showing that we are in totally uncharted territory at present. What is this chart? This chart compares the real rate on German bonds, which are some of the most expensive government bonds on earth and in history, and it takes basically the real rate on German bonds and compares them to the growth currently experienced by Germany. So, you know, the idea, and you see that also in the next slide, the idea is that the real rate in Germany are heavily negative at present, because what you had was that at the turn of the year, in 2016, at the end of 2016, inflation started to resurface. So you had deflation, and all of a sudden you had a pickup in inflation, which is exactly what you see in the next page, on the next slide. You see that inflation picked up, whereas nominal rates on German bonds continued their descent, and they continued deeper into negative territory because, obviously, of the ECB policy, of the policies of the central bank. So at that point, you had a gap opening up between nominal rates and inflation, which means that the real yields were becoming very, very negative. And you see here a table with the negative yields being minus 2.5 on average. Now, rates typically are correlated to inflation, so this is a disconnect that in itself is very difficult to justify, also from the viewpoint of central banks. And the other thing that interest rates are correlated to is growth. And we know that very well, that long-term interest rates, they tend to converge on nominal growth expectations for the economy. So here in this one indicator, which we call the real rate to growth ratio, we put it all together. So we compare the nominal rate to inflation and to growth. And we end up seeing this, that these bonds have never been so expensive because they are in deep negative territory, despite a GDP which has a resurface. It's not anymore zero negative. It is close to 2% as far as Germany is concerned. Why is this the case? Obviously, this is the case because of flows, passive flows from central banks. Every month, still, as we speak, $300 billion equivalent of safe assets and also some risky assets are bought by major central banks. $300 billion still. A lot is being planned in terms of tapering. The ECB will move from 60 to 30. The Federal Reserve has already said that the next year they will wind it down and they will tighten the balance sheet for the first time. And we know also the possibility for the Bank of England to do the same. But as we speak, we live through peak quantitative easing, $300 billion per month, which means that in 2017, $3.7 trillion have been printed just to buy government bonds and some mortgages, corporate bonds, and in some countries also some equities like Switzerland and Japan. So bonds are in a definite bubble, uncontroversial bubble here as well. And when you compare equity with bonds, you kind of fool yourself a little. It's really not so much about valuations. It's really about flows and the flows that come from the central bank. They first make bonds expensive, and as a consequence, they make equity expensive. But now both have become so expensive that is really striking. And the point that I would like to make here is that we have seen many crises in the past, many moments of big adjustments and downfalls in markets in 1929, in 2000, 2007, 1987, 1966. But this will be the first one, if it does go down in the way that we expect, where you don't find bonds expensive at the outset of the movement. So in all those years, rates were not that low and minuscule, close to zero. In all those years, rates were quite fat. So you could have, in all those moments, a moment in time in which equity could lose 50%, but at least bonds were making quite a lot of money. So the balanced portfolios around the world were still fine or just not damaged as much as they could be today, when equities is expensive and bonds are expensive as well, to the point that they can never be more expensive than this because they already trade for most part at negative rates.
Now, I want to push back on this with a hypothetical question. What if I said to you, look, Francesco, you're absolutely right that both equities and bonds are in a bubble. I couldn't agree more. But I could have told you that 2 years ago. And guess what? That bubble has just continued to inflate more and more. As you said, we have unprecedented quantitative easing that's been fueling all of this. So a momentum-oriented investor would say, why not jump on board the long side of this and ride the ride up? This bubble keeps on getting bigger. What's the proximal trigger? What's the catalyst that's going to pop the bubble and eventually cause this massive market move to reverse direction?
Well, there can be a catalyst or there can be no catalyst, right? If you talk about catalyst, I could argue, you know, there can be inflation. For example, at the moment, we have seen that inflation resurfaced. We have seen some tightness in the job market. It has not translated yet into the in wages growth and therefore inflation. But we could just be about to see that. And in that case, rates would rise and they would provoke as a catalyst the kind of downfall that we expect. Or the catalyst could be political. You know that a lot of the quantitative easing is being created and it is benefiting only the, you know, the top 1% of the population. And it is resulting in the so-called income inequality concept. And, you know, like so much the central banks are pursuing, you know, the wealth effect. So try to make people richer for them to spend more in the real economy. But in reality, what they are really triggering is income inequality. The consequence of income inequality is populism. Populism can provoke a regime change. The regime change can then affect quantitative easing if the result was not to help the real economy and the you know the middle classes, but only the top 1%. So the catalyst could be political. But I can also argue, or the catalyst could be China. China is a huge problem of over indebtedness. You know, it is said to be between 300 and 600% of GDP, where GDP is $11 trillion. So it's a monumental credit bubble that could give troubles at any point. And if it gives troubles, you can expect the whole world to listen carefully, like it did in August 2015 and the January 2016, and even more than that. So I think that it can be also no catalyst. And why is it no catalyst? Because at moments in which the market is overvalued, you can never know for sure how much further the bubble can go. But at some point, you know that it reaches a tipping point, a critical mass, where the probability is higher and higher for it to fall down. I would refer to a concept like the Minsky, you know, point of tipping point after which new credit doesn't achieve nothing more in terms of generation of growth, but not even in terms of ability to pay for the interest rate payments on previous debt. And so the same is true also for the prices on the stock markets, for example. You know, I could argue that the valuations are so full, they can get fuller, but at some point they become so irrational that they make no sense, and the risk is there for them to fall off a cliff. You know, like Claudio Borio, who is at the BIS, has recently said, you know, that the financial booms, they don't go indefinitely. At some point they fall under their own weight. And, you know, to use an analogy, you know, you could say, you know, nothing is here to say that the economy is doing badly. The economy is beautiful. If you compare the economy to a washing machine, you know, I can say this is a beautiful washing machine, but still I'm not prepared to pay $10,000 for it. You know, so at some point you reach a level at which you say this is enough, and then for a catalyst or no catalyst, you know, you have in front of you a moment of big adjustment.
Your next section here in your presentation is titled Market Fragility. So why don't you talk us through this diagram on page 10? What's going on here with the fake market cycle?
The fake market cycle is one where basically economic narratives are utilized to justify whatever happens in the market, good or bad, in retrospect. So let's say the market doesn't go down on a Brexit match and then immediately recovers and goes into new highs. The market doesn't go down on a Trump event, immediately recovers and then goes into new highs. You know, and basically what we call here is like those fake narratives. So narratives in retrospect that they are able to justify a movement in the market that was not due really to investor interpreting the event all of a sudden in a totally different manner, but rather a market which is primarily driven by flows, where these flows are primarily passive from central banks and then primarily passive from the private investment community. So what we, in the fake market cycle, what we try to say is that, you know, ignore narratives that are very elusive and that they are overfitting. They always come as exposed. Try to challenge them. Try not to really fall in the induction trap, which is one of the most prominent psychological biases. But look at money flows. And you will see, if you read the market from the viewpoint of the money flows, that they are justifying every single movement in the market over the past several years. And, you know, in the fake market cycles, we see markets going up because of the central banks, which are joined by passive strategies, and I think our next slide will be exactly on that, trying to understand the relationship between central banks' flows and the passive private investment community. The two, they reinforce each other. They push the market higher. At some point, you have bad data, and those bad data, they get interpreted in different manners. Like at some point, there was a moment in the market a couple of years ago where whenever we saw bad data, the market was rallying because they were expecting more monetary printing and more interventionism from the side of central banks. A little bit later, when it was like when rates were falling because of deflation, the narrative was chasing yields. So the narrative was not that there is deflation, therefore there will be a recession, therefore there will be a deflationary bust. But the narrative was that there will be a deflationary boom. So the narrative was chase yields. So go into bonds, even if the yields are low, whenever there is some yields left, go into equity to get some yield, and so make equities more expensive. Then later on, pretty much about when Mr. Trump won the elections, you had a new narrative coming in, which was the chasing growth and chasing reflation. And the whole market was repositioning for that, going long banks and short utilities and so forth. So at this point, the market was not worried, as it could have been, about higher rates, the impact that higher rates could have had on Italy, for example, which is spending 3.6% of GDP in just interest rate payments on government bonds. But the narrative was positive, was about reflation. At some point, the reflation story was challenged because it was all too clear that it was not really happening. You could see that the big pickup in soft data was closing the gap down to the downside on hard data. And you could see that the hard data were always very weak, and soft data went up and then came back down. So the reflation story was not there anymore. But then there was another story that could convince investors that what was happening was making sense, which was to chase earnings. Earnings around the mid of this year, after the second quarter, there were the one bit of positive information out there. So the market was focusing, laser focus on that only, and that was becoming the driving narrative. But it was a fake narrative, because in reality it was really about flows, in our opinion. The current narrative nowadays is a synchronized global GDP growth. How many times have you heard that? You know, and that we see it all the time, and that is justifying the fact that indices are reaching new highs, except nobody is discussing about how this growth is achieved for how much debt, and the debt on GDP that is on the shoulders of governments that is unheard in modern financial history. So our point in this slide is that the fake market cycle is trying to prove that it is not really about narratives. The narratives are exposed and they are just handy excuses, but the point of this market is about flows, the passive flows from the public central banks, from the private investment community, from the ETFs to all the new investment strategies. And therefore, our point here is to challenge our assumptions about this market and be prudent, because, you know, the future is really wide open. Anything could happen now that flows are coming back. And for the first time, we see tapering and quantitative tightening.
It should come as no surprise that there's synchronized GDP growth when you have synchronized money printing all around the world. You know, my background is in engineering, so I always think about systems in terms of whether or not they're inherently stable. And an inherently stable system has feedback loops where when something gets out of whack, it fixes itself. And an unstable system is one where the feedback loops end up resulting in the situation getting worse rather than better. So I was delighted to see your emphasis using some engineering terminology, which is rare in finance. Please tell us on slide 12 what you're talking about here with positive feedback loops and how they affect this whole cycle.
Yeah, exactly. As you said, whenever there are positive feedback loops, and that is true in engineering, in cybernetics, in chemistry, in biology, whenever you have that, you have the possibility of a self-fulfilling prophecy and a reinforcing process. You have reflexivity. You have a number of things that they provoke a further diversion from fundamentals, or call it from general equilibrium, and the system instability. And this is the case right now, in my opinion. The system instability is further defined as a state in the markets in which a small disturbance is able to produce a very large adjustment. So, you know, whenever you said before, like, what is the catalyst? And I said that there could also not be a catalyst, that things could happen all of a sudden because of this very fragile state of affairs, and because of the fact that it's very, you know, that it's very unstable, this equilibrium. And, you know, and to use an analogy, and then I'll deeper into this slide, to use an analogy, when you talk about an unstable equilibrium, you should think of a pendulum which is held in a vertical position. And the pendulum that is held in a vertical position stands still, it looks really stable, but a small disturbance is able to crash it down left or right. And when the equilibrium is stable instead of unstable, you should think of it as a painting, which is attached to the nail, and it can move a little bit left and then goes back to the original position, a little bit right, and then goes back to the original position. The market is like a pendulum, held in vertical position in our opinion. So what happens? There are these massive public passive flows, right? This is central banks. In the last 10 years, roughly, they printed $15 trillion, and they've spent that money into buying financial assets, primarily government bonds, but also some risky assets like mortgages, and in some countries, as I said, Switzerland and Japan, also directly equities. Japan owns the majority of the ETF industry in Japan for $200 billion equivalent, and the Swiss Central Bank owns $100 billion worth of stocks, primarily U.S. stocks. Now, we live through the peak of QE. What are the two major factors that were originated by these 15 trillion printing and these huge monumental money flows? There are two. There is a factor trend and there is a factor volatility. You know, the two consequences of those flows were, you know, trending markets upward, obviously, because of all those flows, and financial repression of volatility, which means really volatility being killed to the ground and going into new all-time lows. Those are two consequences of those monumental money flows. Those two factors have an impact, a reflexive impact on the private community, because the whole private community adjust to those two factors. So here we have a cursory look at all the players involved, some of the players involved, going from ETF and passive index funds to all the fashionable investment strategies nowadays of risk parity, risk premia, algorithmic, short vol ETF, machine learning, etc., etc. And you could see that 90% of this investment community is affected by either one of those factors, volatility or trend, or both of them. 90% of the most fashionable investment community and the most successful at present is either going long a trend, so long only, or it is a short in volatility or benefiting from low levels of volatility. So the day that either one of those two factors changes direction, volatility goes up or the trend goes down, you can expect the whole community to move in one shot. So this slide is intended to prove that the whole market looks like in a one large big position, which is long only, fully invested when it's not leveraged, which is a short volatility, and therefore it is also short gamma and short convexity, and it is exposed to the benefit of lower interest rates. So it is going to be damaged if interest rates go up. So if I can spend a minute on this, and a minute more, I will say that ETFs are the most, what you would expect, right? You know, rates are going down, so it is very difficult for managers to make a performance and to justify fees. Therefore, there is from the investment community an obsession for fees. Therefore, these ETFs are able, obviously, to be produced for very little cost, for total expense ratios of less than a half a point, and for management fees of 9 basis points, or even smaller than that. Even we have seen some ETFs for 3 basis points of management fees. So they are a byproduct of the current environment of lower and lower interest rates, which is produced by central banks. What do, the ETFs? They obviously go long only, right, by definition. And they don't price any risk inside portfolios. ETFs, when you buy a certain subset of the market through an ETF, that ETF will not decide to be underweight for any reason. Not because there is a big election coming up, not because there is a potential nuclear strike in North Korea, not because there is a valuation problem. That investment will be mindless and will be long only and will be fully invested. And this is number one. Now, the ETFs alone, they represent close to 90% of the equity flows daily on the S&P these days. And this is an estimation coming from Vanguard, which is the number one shopper for ETFs. A different estimation from Bank of America Merrill Lynch sees the 70% of the flows due to ETFs. But, you are talking about very big percentage. Now, why is that they are so dominant? Because of the turnover of the ETF. So in total, they are $4 trillion globally. But their turnover is 10 times bigger than the turnover on the underlying stocks. On average, they have indeed a 10 times turnover. So they move just in the U.S. $15 trillion worth of assets. Now, the next asset class is risk parity and vol target funds. They benefit from a trend upward, and they benefit from a down movement of volatility. What is a risk parity? A risk parity is a balanced portfolio, pretty much, which goes long bonds and equity and allocates on the basis of risk, so on the basis of expected volatility for both asset classes. The lower yield, the lower the volatility, the more size they put and the more leverage they put on bonds, and the more leverage they put on the overall portfolio. So that you should know whenever volatility is low that in order to maintain their investment expectations and return expectations, they are utilizing leverage. And the leverage doesn't look like that risky because volatility is low. Except volatility is a byproduct of central bank activities, so you cannot really rely on it as much as you are doing right now. Risk parity funds have been working for 20 years, so they have seen some bear market on bonds, but very little ones. Bonds have really been, in 1994, bonds have really been rallying all the way through from in the last 40 years. So this could be the first market where, for the first time, a risk parity fund sees a combined sell-off in equities and bonds, for which they are just not designed. How big are they? I mean, the old market, when they quote the numbers on risk parity funds, they speak of low numbers, less than $1 trillion. What is not taken into account is that very often the leverage on those funds is 2 to 3 times. And therefore, the size is much bigger than it looks when they purely look at the asset under management of those strategies. And in addition to that, the risk parity funds, they are not in a vacuum. There are a lot of other vehicles which are short volatility or which are volatility target funds or where volatility is delivered on the basis of which asset allocation is decided. So if you put everything in one basket, you reach the staggering amount of $3.75 trillion of AUM after leverage, which is like really, really big. And you can expect it to really behave badly if bonds start to sell off violently together with equity. Then you have another bucket, which is an interesting one, and I think we will touch upon it in the next few slides, which is the short vol ETF. For the purposes of this slide, I would say that we have found out that if a vol doubles up from current levels, so the VIX goes from 9 to 20, 18, 20, some of these ETFs are going to be wiped out. They are going to trigger termination events on some of these notes. So this is really an accident waiting to happen, and it is linked to volatility. Then you have trend algorithmic funds, like you count around 750 billion around the world. Two-thirds of it is trend following, trend chasing, and this does exactly what it says. Whenever the trend inverts, they will follow the trend. So at least they say the truth and they don't put up any story. And then you have a number of strategies which they probably don't say the full truth. They probably are nice commercial disguise for being long and selling volatility. And in this bucket, I consider, in addition to risk parity funds, also alternative risk premium and machine learning and artificial intelligence. Here we are talking about a market in total of $350 billion of AUM. It's a very big market nowadays. And, I speak about a commercial disguise for something which is long and short vol, because in reality, momentum is a key factor in a lot of risk premium funds. In machine learning, the whole point is to try to detect a certain investment pattern and try to take advantage of it. But the reality of the matter is that a lot of the big data created is only 2 years or 3 years old. So a lot of it has been deducted upon the time series of the last few years, which is heavily manipulated by central bank activity. So if you are a machine learning enterprise and you try to detect something in the last 36 months of data, what is there to know if not that Buy the Dip was a technology that was able to beat even Buy and Hold as a strategy? So, it doesn't take much to understand that will be the conclusion of the sophisticated technology being put at work. And whatever is not that, it's probably not as successful and as producing in terms of returns as that. So I'm not saying that this is a fake in terms of investment sector. I think machine learning will definitely be the future in so many industries, including also finance. Risk premium is also a great technology. But what here I'm trying to say is that there is a crowding effect. There is a very high probability that there has been a dissemination of two factors, volatility factor and trend factor, across strategies because of the time series that has been created due to the manipulation of flows from central banks. So my point here is that the passive players are not uncontingent to the artificial flows which have been generated by the central banks. And if they all look at the manipulated time series, they are going to be very likely to derive a manipulated model output from it. And that is the source of my captiveness. So all of this to conclude that, because of this microstructure, I guess the positive feedback loops is created in such a way in which the public flows, they buy only, or they never sell, they only buy. They created this investment community, which is successful because they kind of chase and turtle trade those central bank flows because they go long only, fully invested when not leveraged, and they go short volatility. So they help the public flows in creating more and more higher valuations for markets. So they all go in the same direction and they reinforce each other and they create a further divergence from equilibrium. And they create also an illusion of liquidity and an illusion of diversification in the process.
I see looking to the next slide, you're emphasizing that systemic risk comes not just from banks, but also from funds. Please tell us more. What kind of funds are we talking about?
Yeah, here, basically, our point is that, there has been some discussion in the past whether or not, systemic risk institutions should include also funds and not just banks. And the point was, no, they should not, because it's the balance sheet of the bank that matters when the bank goes under. But in reality, what we should see is that the link is those positive feedback loops that I've discussed before, and the impact that they have on the asset management industry, and how much they manage to create a one-sided investment community. And so the point that we try to do in this slide is at present, 90% of the investment strategies out there are either trend-linked or volatility-linked. So they are pointing in the same direction. That creates a systemic risk, because the day the market falls or the day volatility rises for any reason, is going to exacerbate the market reaction, not just because of valuation themselves only, but also because of the market structure itself and how much the market structure has changed on the basis of that market dominated by central banks. And the other point is the concentration of risk on a few top players. This is the month where BlackRock exceeds $6 trillion in asset under management. And it's not just BlackRock. If you top up the first eight players, you reach the staggering amount of $22 trillion. It was only $8 trillion in 2006. At the moment, the top eight players, which are all from the U.S., they top $22 trillion. If you take just the first three or four, you're already at $15 trillion. So it's already a huge concentration. And finally, because of leverage and because of turnover, 90% of the flows in equities are dominated by these passive or quasi-passive players, which really wants to say this slide, there is a huge concentration of risk in the markets right now, which is underestimated and which transforms a market risk into a systemic risk.
Looking ahead to page 15, this slide really caught my eye, because what you're showing here is that European high yield, that's junk bonds, are yielding less than U.S. treasuries. And it just blows my mind to understand. I mean, the notion of how it's possible that we've got negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. Well, you can explain that. You can say that there are people, some institutions by mandate have to invest in sovereign debt at any price. That pushes the price up to the point where the yield is negative. But nobody's mandated to have to buy junk bonds. So who in the world is buying junk bonds and paying a price for them so high that they yield less than U.S. treasuries? How is that occurring?
Well, I mean, it's flows, right? The answer is the flows from central banks and the reflexive impact of flows from the private sector is exactly the positive feedback loops that I was referring to. Nowadays, whoever tries as an investment manager to price risk inside the portfolio, either in a mild format, like underweight the index, so not be invested as much as they could, or in a more in a stronger fashion, like being short, like we do, for example, because we want to stick our neck out and capitalize on the bigger adjustment coming at some point, underperforms, and therefore gets rewarded with the outflows and the redemptions, and those money go into players which don't price risk within the portfolio, and they go long only, fully invested, very often with leverage, and being short volatility. And this is what happens also on high yield. Those flows together with the positive feedback loops is what justifies this level of high yield. Nobody in his right mind would justify you know, high yield in Europe can be beautiful, but the price is wrong. You know, the price could never be a better price than the price on a U.S. Treasury. And not only the price, but also what you get for a certain price. You know, like those high yields nowadays, and also the loans, you know, like part of the same bucket, they are light covenants, and they've got the lowest recovery rates in ages. So not only you get very little for the exposures that you take, but you take also less covenant protection as an investor and less recovery, expected recovery in case of a waterfall. So it's really like a poor investment if you look at the next 10 years and not just at the next 6 months.
Moving ahead to slide 17, this is a topic that absolutely fascinates me, which is buybacks. You know, the amount of easy money in the system that has allowed so many CEOs to just say, hey, I know how to push the stock price up of my own company, which is what I get bonused on. I'll just take advantage of the easy money and buy my own shares. So the thing that really, you know, just keeps echoing in my mind is, when does the easy money get cut off so that these buybacks are not allowed to continue? Because to me, if you want to know what's a catalyst that might change the direction of the equity market, it's when the companies that issue the stocks no longer have the secret weapon of being able to prop up their own shares by borrowing money in order to buy them. When does this come to an end?
Well, I mean, you can argue, first of all, that it does not need to come to an end for the market to go down. The market should go down already, because at the moment the market has even run ahead of itself in terms of the linkage to buybacks, right? As you can see in the chart, buybacks have already decelerated since last year, and the market has kept riding higher and higher. So it's even running ahead of itself on the passive flows that were pushing it in the first place. The other thing that you see in the chart is that, funnily enough, the amount of yearly buybacks peaked at a very similar level to where it peaked in 2007. And in 2007, when it went down in a very glorious fashion with the overall market. So you could also like the chart from different viewpoints if you are bearish like I am. And then I would say, like, yes, they could probably stop. They will stop, I think, or they will very heavily decelerate because of interest rates. Interest rates are rising for so much that we heard from Miss Yellen. Interest rates in the short-end part of the curve kept rising over the last 2 months. We saw the two-year Treasury's yield moving up by 50 basis points, actually, as of today, in just a month and a half, 2 months. So things are moving. So with higher rates, you can expect corporations to be less inclined to do buybacks. The other thing that I would like to make is that buybacks have got a linkage also to income inequality. And so much we have seen in the recent past that can also be taken from a viewpoint of income inequality. You know, we have seen companies like Microsoft, for example, that in 2016 they were able to do buybacks for $40 billion. So you would imagine this is a very healthy moment for the company itself. They were able to boost the dividend, and at the same time, within the same year, they were also able to lay off 10,000 people. So, you see no linkage between buybacks, for example, and the real economy and the middle class. And this is just an example, but there is a long list of companies that they have a similar, you know, they happen to have a very similar outcomes. So I would say there are a lot of catalysts for which buybacks will probably fade away. The first one is interest rates. The second one is income inequality. And the third one is the historical parallel to previous peaks in buybacks and what happens next.
Moving on, I see a topic that's very much near and dear to my heart, which is this whole short vol trade. When this started, there were a few institutions that should have known better that were shorting vol to take advantage of that contango yield in the futures curve. Now we've gotten to the point where people I know tell me that they go to the restaurant and the waitress in the restaurant is short vol through the ETF. That's one of those moments where you know there's a problem, is when the waitress in the restaurant is short vol and clearly doesn't have a thorough understanding of what risk is inherent to that. Tell us, you've got several slides here. Tell us the highlights of this short vol situation and what can go wrong.
The short vol situation is really like a pressure cooker in the market nowadays. It is not as big in terms of number of billions involved with the strategy, but it is big in terms of the closeness that you got to a wipeout event. So what is surprising here is not so much that it can lose money, anything can lose money, but how quickly it can lose 100% of the money invested in the strategy. The theory goes, for whenever you want to short volatility, that for you to really run into troubles, you need to have volatility doubling up from current levels in a short manner. And the theory goes that it never happened in the past. Now, the problem is that, at the moment, volatility, as measured by the VIX on the S&P, is only 9. So for it to double up, it really only requires for it to go to 20, right? And guess what? 20 is the historical average. 20 is no less, no more than the historical average. So for it to move quickly into 20, it wouldn't be able to surprise anybody because it's just where it's been most of the time in history. It's just the norm, it's not the exception. So here you have a point in time in which if it ever was able to go to 20, and to go to 20 just really takes the S&P to drop for any reason on a number of days, a short number of days, by 5%. So it doesn't take much. And if it ever was to go to 20, we calculated here in these few slides and in our further research that a number of ETFs linked to short volatility positions would be close to be wiped out. And wipe out is defined as losing more than 75% of the capital. And within the contracts that you have embedded sometimes liquidity gates and termination events, which means you lose more than that, the note gets withdrawn. So it is a really big problem, and it is the closest analogy I would find is the one of a pressure cooker at present.
Well, in the interest of time, we are not able to go into every single one of your slides in this deck, but I know a lot of our listeners are going to be interested in finding out more about your work, as well as what you do at Fasanara Capital. So please tell us, what do you do at Fasanara Capital? And for people who are interested in following more of your work, is there a website or a blog? What's the best place to follow what you do?
Fasanara Capital is a fund, is an hedge fund involved into a number of strategies. We have different vehicles, open flagship vehicles, which are multi-strategy funds, and then thematic funds, which they look at specific investment opportunities. At the moment, our open funds, flagship funds, are bearish. So we want to bank on the coming adjustment in risky assets that we see coming. We think this is an amazing opportunity. As a fund manager, it must be great to live in a moment in time in which there are so great imbalances. It's not for free. It's not popular at the moment. It takes you to go through periods of underperformance. But at the same time, that is the price to pay for you to be able to see the end of the movie. And within the end of the movie will be a big moment of adjustment. You can find the information about ourselves on our portal, which is www.fasanara.com. We put our research in there, so you can find our most recent notes. We would be happy to hear your thoughts on the ideas presented today.
Well, Francesco, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Now, Eric, what a great interview with Francesco. And before we discuss, I wanted to welcome the macro tourist, Kevin Muir, to the show. Hi, Kev.
Great to be with you guys today.
From the moment I read Francesco's work back in October, I was eager to get him on the show. Now, while he does get into the issues like valuations, it was his emphasis on the feedback loops that was most interesting to me. What did you find interesting, Eric?
Well, I think that was the slide where he really got into the key things. There's going to be something that sets off the next crisis that'll be different in its shape and form from anything else we've ever seen before. And he had all of the major candidates on that slide. One is risk parity just being overdone and the potential unwind of that. Another is ETFs and this whole passive investing trend. And, you know, the thing I keep saying is when ETFs were invented, we had an active market of natural buyers and sellers for individual stocks. And that's where those stocks came from that are in the ETFs. These days, everybody uses ETFs for everything. So when everybody starts selling the ETFs, and that means that the market makers are forced as they destroy units of the ETF to sell those underlying shares, who are they going to sell them to? when there's no more market for natural buyers and sellers of individual issue shares. There used to be the market makers would fill some of that in. Market makers have been put out of business by high-frequency traders. He talked about short vol being a potential trigger. He talked about a lot of systemic risks. And I think he really understands that, you know, we've got this super low vol environment that's going to allow things to continue as they are with equity markets powering higher and higher until someday when something breaks that's different than we've ever seen before. And I think he's got exactly the right list of potential candidates on that slide.
That's some great insights there. Now, what did you think of the interview, Kev?
Well, I loved it. His double bubble philosophy just really struck a chord with me. I especially loved his part where he talked about the German bond market being just the biggest bubble we've seen in ages. I don't think enough people are really looking at it and realizing how overpriced the German bonds are and what a disaster they're going to be when they need to normalize monetary policy.
All right. Well, you know, Kev, you just recently wrote a blog piece on your Macro Tourist that it was entitled Grandma's Bond Portfolio is in Trouble and the Coming War Between Generations. Now, tell me if I've got this right, but the gist of it was that, you know, we've gone from two polar opposites, one where everyone believed central banks were about to create this big inflation and there was huge worries about it, to now us being in the exact opposite scenario where now everyone believes the central banks can't do this. You know, you shared two charts there, one on the dollar and one on excess bank reserves. Tell us what you're thinking here.
Well, you know, when I was writing this piece, I went and dug up a letter that was an open letter to Ben Bernanke. And I looked at it and it was basically a letter from a whole bunch of very distinguished fellows from Cliff Asness, from AQR, John Taylor from Stanford. There's the who's who of kind of smart guys wrote this letter saying how QE2 was going to be this huge disaster and how Ben shouldn't do it. And I joked and said, when these guys wrote this letter, this is much more serious. This isn't one of these doomsdayers spouting on about the inflationary problems. These were some very serious fellows felt that this was going to be a big mistake. And much to everyone's surprise, QE2 and QE3, QE infinity, as we spoke about it, or called it eventually, ended up creating no inflation. And I went about in my post trying to figure out why this was and to understand why it is. I went back to Milton Friedman's work and I went and looked at the equation, his MV equals PQ, which means money supply times velocity equals price, which is the level of inflation times quantity. And what everyone assumed when we increased the supply of money was that that was going to increase the price on the other side of the equation. What most people didn't forecast was that instead of the prices going up, the velocity of money was going to collapse. And this is the part that all those fellows on the letter kind of misjudged. And it's kind of ironic now that everyone has assumed that more quantitative easing will not create inflation. We've gone, as you say, I think you described it very well, the polar opposite. Whereas before, QE kind of ushered in these kind of nightmare scenarios where everyone was rushing to gold and selling bonds, to a point where QE is viewed as a panacea that's going to basically just kind of create a good feel-good feeling that sends up financial markets. And I think that that's about to change.
Let's continue, Kev, on that point. Why do you think it's going to change?
Well, I think it was a perfect storm what happened after the great financial crisis. It basically comes down to two points when you're deciding why the velocity of money fell. Was it because there was limited supply of credit available, or was it because there's limited demand? A lot of people think that it's limited demand, meaning that the central banks are pushing on a string. And then no matter what price you put it out there, it basically, people don't want to borrow. They've already borrowed enough and they're underwater. They don't want any more borrowing. I think that there was more going on than that. I thought it was actually three factors. One, which was the increase in the Basel rules in terms of the regulation. In the aftermath of the great financial crisis, everyone had it out for the banksters. They were basically wanted someone to put on a stick. And what they did was they clamped down on regulations and they said, never again. But in doing so, what they did was they made it much more difficult for banks to lend. So you saw Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan complaining about this all the time, that the regulation was increased all over the place. And basically they weren't allowed to lend. You know, at one point, Ben Bernanke went to try to refinance his house and he got declined. And it just showed you how the actual rules had been tightened up. The other big factor was that in downturns, governments often pick up the pace and spend when there's a lack of demand from private individuals. But in the Obama administration, he was hampered by the Tea Party. And actually, even though everyone thinks that he was a spendthrift president, his discretionary spending went down during this period. So we had a situation where the government wasn't spending, individuals weren't able to spend, and basically there was no credit being created. So when we look back at this, it's actually amazing that we created any inflation at all. And it's no surprise that when they kept pushing money into the system, instead of it going into the real economy, all it did was go into financial assets.
All right, Kev, but I do have to ask you, like, what is the actual catalyst here on the short term? Why do you think that this is all about to change? Because I've always been more on the deflation camp, and I led that pushing on the string thing. I've always shared that idea. But what's the catalyst right now? Why is it that this is somehow going to change in the next year?
Well, I think that Trump is a big change. I think that he wants to spend, he wants to deregulate, and he wants to get this economy moving. And between all those factors, he's going to lighten up in terms of all the regulation that these banks have been encumbered by. He's going to go and actually, even though the Republicans talk about being a party that wants to, you know, manage the books and make sure that they balance budgets, the reality is that when you go look at history, they're actually some of the biggest spenders out there. So I think that there's been a tone shift, and that what you're going to find is both the supply and the demand are going to increase. And we could be surprised at how much velocity jumps out of nowhere and actually surprises everyone to the upside.
Kev, I'd like to move on to a chart that you sent us, because as much as I really enjoyed Francesco's perspective on this short vol trade and why it poses systemic risks, I think he's exactly right. Boy, nothing really hits you in the face like this chart that you sent us. So that is in the download link for that chart, folks, is in your Research Roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says looking for the downloads for instructions there. Kevin, walk us through this amazing chart. It really is very compelling.
Right. So I created a chart of the VXX, which is the long VIX ETF. And what a lot of people don't realize is how many times it's split. And it just can splits and splits and splits. And when you actually adjust for all those splits and go back to 2009, you realize that the wealth destruction in VXX has been just unbelievable. It's gone from $120,000 per share to its current price of $35. And I went in and just for kind of kicks, I went and looked at the Sharpe ratio. What do you think the Sharpe ratio is, Eric?
Negative.
Well, yeah, it's negative. But so what would be a great Sharpe ratio for a hedge fund?
Anything over 2 or 3 is usually pretty good.
That's right. So the negative Sharpe ratio for the VXX is 5.3 on a 1-year basis. So that means that if you had gone and shorted that the returns for the risk is just unbelievable.
Well, and it's of course the nature, I think, of the way that the finance, and this is to me one of the major failings of academic finance, is it is believed that volatility and risk are almost the same thing, and they're not. Volatility is a proxy for risk in the case of normally distributed returns, which is not the way the real world works. And this has been an incredibly, just a cash cow for so many people. It's going to end very badly someday. And I think that's what's missing. Nothing is that good unless it has the other side of the coin. And that side of the coin just hasn't been flipped yet.
Eric, you're absolutely correct. And Interactive Brokers, one of the largest electronic brokers out there, realizes the risk. And if you go look at the way that they're margining these products, they're margining them completely different than what the exchanges and everyone else says is the proper amount. So if you go look at the VIX futures, the front month is 6,200, the exchange minimum is 6,200, which works out to roughly 50% of a contract. The next month is 4,000, which works out to 30% of a contract. And the farm months are 2,500, which works out to 17% of a contract. But if you go to Interactive Brokers and you want to sell this VIX contract short, you have to put up 300-400% of the contract. because they've gone and they've looked at it and they've realized that if the S&P has a 10% down move, which isn't out of the realm of possibility, that the VIX could spike up to $37 really easily. And people are going to be wiped out if that happens.
Yeah, and I don't think that what the people who are shorting the VIX understand is what this really means is, let's suppose that everybody wanted some kind of portfolio insurance where somebody would be there to bail things out if things turn bad, if this systemic risk that Francesco talks about shows up and we have a really dramatic stock market risk. Suppose that I want to have some kind of insurance policy where somebody else is going to be the one to absorb the loss. It's the people that are buying these short VIX products that are volunteering to be the ones that will be the sacrificial cows when things fall apart. And I don't think they know that that's what they're signing up for.
No, you're absolutely correct. There's $1.2 billion of the XIV, which is the short ETF. There's $1.3 billion of the SVXY, which is another short one. These are staggering numbers. And, you know, in my days when I was on the institutional desk, we had this big, I did index arbitrage, and we used to go out and we used to buy the baskets and sell the futures. One day the risk manager came to me and he said, you know, if you had to take this position off because we had accumulated this big position, how long would it take you and who would do it? And I said, the reality is that there's nobody, you know, we were the biggest player in the market and there was nobody that was going to take this off of us. The only way was to go all the way to expiry. Well, the reality is that these numbers are way bigger than any market player can absorb. And if we get a situation where, as Francesco says, all it's going to take is a return of the VIX from its current level of 10 to its average level of 18 or 19 to wipe out these products. And I guess that's the point that I want to make, is that if you're actually owning these things, you should be aware that all it will take is a move of 80%, and then they're going to wind down these products. So the XIV, when it moves up, if all of a sudden VIX goes from 10 to 18 in a day, they're going to wind down that product. And what's going to be really scary is the amount of VIX futures that is going to have to be bought, because they're short all those VIX futures and they're going to have to buy them back. And I just don't know who's going to sell it to them. And, you know, for the first time, for a long time, I didn't view this VIX as that big a deal. And there was some smart guys like Jesse Felder that were going on about it. I just think that it has been taken to a level that is becoming increasingly worrisome, and it actually could create, you know, a market dislocation in itself. What is it, Warren Buffett, that says what the wise man does in the beginning, the fool does in the end? Well, we're at VIX at this point. We're hitting a point where if you're actually continuing to bet on it, you're going to be in the fool category, because it's not going to take much to have a big spike that wipes a lot of people out. And it's actually very, very worrisome.
Now, Kev, when we're looking at a scenario like this, obviously it would take a big stock market move. And, you know, I was reading that recent piece from Michael Harnett from Bank of America. And essentially he was suggesting that there's going to be this liquidity event, this idea that there's going to be this almost like a 1987 style market event. And the thing is that if we have this big drawdown, one thing that we never hear a lot of people talking about is this idea of what happens if the market ever hit some of these circuit breakers on the down end and we actually went limit down. Do you have any ideas on how that could play out?
Yeah, so it's been a while since we've had the S&P actually be halted. And I remember when they first instituted the circuit breakers and they made them too tight, and we used to hit them all the time because I think they were 2 or 3%. They've widened them out. So I dug up the rules, and actually the first circuit breaker is at 7%. So which means that 7%, if it happens in the first kind of 9:30 to 3:30, it'll be halted for, how long is it here? 20 or 30 minutes. And everyone gets a little bit of a cooling off period. And then all of a sudden they let it trade again. And then the next circuit breaker is 13%. And again, it's halted for 20 or 30 minutes. And then we get finally the final one where it's 20% and you're done for the day. It's been a long time since we've had one of those done for the days. I distinctly remember being on the desk and heading home early because they hit the limit and there was no more trading for the day.
And do you really think that that could happen with this kind of a catalyst such as the VIX?
Oh, for sure. Because I think that the VIX is going to feed on itself. Once we get into a situation where it starts to rise and we get a situation where people need to buy no matter what, I just don't see who's going to sell it to them. So if we get a situation where VIX is trading at 20%, but the futures are trading 30 or 40%, I think that this VIX could actually feed on itself if we get a big rally. What a lot of people don't realize is how intricate and how complicated the VIX is. The VIX isn't something that's arbitrageable. Like, it's not like you can actually go and buy VIX. What you can do is buy futures that expire into it. And yes, you can go and hedge in the options, but realistically, what you're betting on is what the future implied volatility will be. And so that means that we could get a situation where it could trade significantly above the actual underlying. We could see the VIX trading at 20, but futures are trading at 40 or 50. This could happen in a situation where there's just no natural sellers. Right now, all you can see is seller after seller after seller. But what happens when all of a sudden this turns on them and they're all offside and they need to get it back? It could be scary. I'm actually in Jesse Felder's camp that this is one of the big risks for the market right now.
Well, I think it's even bigger than what you've described so far. I agree with you. It's huge because the way that futures work is if you get underwater on your position, you owe money back to the broker and the exchange. You know, it's not a question of just your account went to zero, you lost all your money and you're done. It's you lost all your money, you ended up with a negative balance and you've got to come up with money, you know, sell your house, sell your car in order to come up with the money to cover that deficit. Stocks don't work that way. So when you've got a stock, which is what ETFs are, you know, so you look at something like XIV, it's basically organized as an equity security, which invests in shorting VIX futures. So if they're massively short VIX futures, and VIX futures have a dramatic 1987 size move up, and they're negative equity, which means they owe the exchange $1 billion. And there's no capital left because the value of the XIV has gone to zero. They had a plan. They thought they were going to unwind it by buying futures quickly, and it didn't work. Well, then what do they do? And the answer is, at that point, the company that organized the ETF, maybe they get wiped out, but that's not very much capital. Now what you end up with is the exchange fails. And at that point, you've got, you know, anything can happen because regulators have to look at how to protect the system overall. Do they end up saying the people that were on the other side of that trade get whistled out somehow because, you know, they can't let the exchange fail? There's so many things that can go so incredibly badly wrong. What happens if XIV is in margin deficit and owes $200 million or $2 billion to the exchange? Who's going to come up with the money? Then what?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Eric. It's frightening. And I don't think enough people are, well, there are some, but I don't think that enough people are really considering all these things. And I think that guys like the Interactive Broker Chairman that are taking proactive steps to make sure that there's enough margin, we need to see more of that. We need to see more people saying, hey, wait, this is actually a very, very scary instrument that has a lot of risk in it. You know, I watched a Real Vision interview with John Hempton from Bronte Capital, and he talked about phoning up the infamous target salesman guy, the fellow that quit his job as a target manager to trade XIV and all the VXX products. And he turned his $500,000 into $13 million. And the part that really scared me about it was that John phoned him up and he was expecting to see, you know, talk to this very sophisticated guy. And his basic takeaway was that although he had a lot of buzzwords and he understood kind of what the products represented, he didn't really understand his true risk. And I think that there's just a myriad of people out there that are trading these things that don't understand that. The more people that kind of, you know, wake up and realize this and stop playing this game, the better off we'll be, actually.
Really important thing we have to get across here is it's not just the risk to them. The fact that the target manager who's investing all of his $13 million in this short vol product is taking a risk he maybe doesn't understand. That's not the point. The point is that when things really get squirrely and against that $13 million, he now owes $130 million that he doesn't have. That means somebody else doesn't get the benefit that they thought they were assured of from something else. And what's the something else and what's the benefit they don't get? It's so freaking complicated that it's hard to even figure out. But there's capital missing from the system and there's nobody to fill in the gap. And so you start getting to all kinds of default scenarios and all kinds of things going wrong. You know, what happens if you're long VXX And you use that as a hedge to protect a portfolio, and even though you know you're paying a huge carry on it. But then when it really, you know, is needed, VXX goes up to, you know, from $32 a share up to $400 a share. But then it gets declared to be bankrupt because the guys on the other side of the trade couldn't ante up. And your hedge is actually worthless, and you don't have the protection that you thought you had in place for your portfolio. Well, that's not fair to you. Okay, well, it's not fair, but who's going to be on the hook for it? The guy who was on the other side of the trade doesn't have any money. And the exchange, as you say, allowed these things to be margined in a way where the other guys all got underwater massively. Everybody on the other side of the trade, you know, owes more than their net worth. They're never going to come up with the money. Other people who were on the right side of the trade paying a negative carry in order to have that protection of something like calls on the VIX or long VIX futures as a hedge against a market event, don't really have the protection they thought they did because the guys on the short VIX trade are not able to ante up because they don't fully understand all the risks that they're signing up for. It's a really, really ugly picture.
That's a great point, Eric. You know, it kind of reminds me of the Hunt debacle when the Hunt brothers cornered the silver market. When they got squeezed, all of the exchange basically declared a force majeure, and they made it so that trades wouldn't actually occur at the real market price. And that could actually happen in the VIX as well. They could say, instead of this thing settling at $50, like it's where it's trading, we actually have to keep everything solvent. We just arbitrarily choose $30. And so it is a risk, you're right, that the people on the long side of the product should also think about. It's not just the people that are actually trading it from the short side.
Yeah, anybody who's trading any derivative always has a counterparty. And the worst case is when you're not sure who the counterparty is.
Well, Kev, thank you for joining us for this postgame. Your insights were just fabulous. Now, Eric, you wanted to give us a quick update on this year-end show. Why don't you fill us in?
Well, Patrick, as you know, we originally set out to do a couple of 45-minute shows with Luke Groman, Mark Yusko, and Jeff Snyder. And it was originally conceived to be a pretty simple concept, which is bullish or bearish the U.S. dollar. And that was going to be two 45-minute segments that we would air over the holidays. I don't want to spoil the surprise, but it has evolved dramatically. It's not just a bull versus bear on the dollar. It's really a much more comprehensive discussion. What I'm going to say is probably the only really level-headed conversation that I've ever heard about how and when the U.S. dollar will eventually lose its reserve currency status. And we're not talking by any stretch about one of these, you know, knucklehead bloggers in South America who's saying we're going to wake up one day and the dollar is crashed and it's worthless and there's martial law. These are really smart finance professionals talking realistically about how Triffin's dilemma will eventually be resolved, how many years will take, and so forth. I'm not going to give away the entire show right now, but I'll just say it's substantially more than we had originally imagined. It's planned to be two 45-minute episodes. We recorded the first 5 hours of that this week, and we're going to do the rest of it next week. So we'll let you know when we figure out how many shows that is, but you're going to have a lot of interesting content to listen to over the holidays. On that note, we are overtime this week. So, folks, we really need your help. This year-end show was made possible by generous donations. Frankly, we overspent the donation budget. So if you're able to donate, please do so. Most importantly, though, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to get the very best feature interview guests on the program. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all the really cool downloads that we have, such as our feature interview guest handouts, as well as a lot of cool, interesting content that we find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. As well, you're going to find the link to the charts that Eric and Francesco discussed throughout the interview. You'll also find the links to the blog article, as well as the charts that Kevin discussed with us in the post-game interview. There's also a link to a recent blog from Variant Perception, which makes the argument that the US dollar is still tactically bullish into the year end. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.